Okay, a couple of simple questions. What's the theme of this letter?
Better.
Better cooking, better...
better covenant, better vested...
What's the theme of this letter?
Authority of Christ.
Sorry?
Supporting of Christ.
Superiority.
That's what I said the first time.
All right, let me tell you, let me share with you two things. One, if you came here, I'm going to try to talk as loud as I can, like everybody, most people in this room, I think, I've got cold, and so you may not be able to hear me, if you can't say so. Second thing is, I can't hear as well this morning. You think I can't hear a bass case, I know, but I can't hear as well this morning, so speak up. Okay, and somebody else answered the next one. What's the word that we found? We did some of the marking. This permeates this, the support, permeates the book, that supports the idea of superiority.
Better.
And I didn't ask you to do this, but there, we looked at better, we looked at more, excellent, and even in one case more, or a couple cases more. And there's another word that shows up, great or greater. And there, in about five cases of that. And so the book is full of these kinds of identifiers. What's the purpose of the letter? As stated by the writer.
To keep us from drifting away and going back in.
Okay, that's the end product he's looking for. 13:22, he calls it an exhortation. So he's exhorting them to be faithful, as we'll see throughout the book. There's a phrase that emphasizes this objective that he has that we looked at in the marking. What is it?
Let us.
And throughout the book, you see numerous places where he tries to encourage by calling his audience.
Is it hot in here? Is the heater coming on or what?
Feels good.
It's hot.
It's a little warm.
I always get that. It's hot, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd open this door. I would say all the hot people sit down here and all the cold people sit down there. Maybe I'll just take my coat off. So this phrase shows up throughout where he's exhorting the audience through this terminology, let us, and we'll keep on visiting that as we go through the book. As we started out getting into the text, does the writer, we start this superiority thing, with whom does he compare Christ?
The prophets.
Yeah, eventually Moses. We haven't hit it yet. But in chapter 1, he starts off by talking about the prophets and then about the angels. And really the angel part of it covers through chapter 2. Man, I wonder what that was. Okay, and number 2, throw your Bibles to Hebrews. And kind of bring us up to speed. Hebrews 1 verse 4 says, after having introduced through 1 through 3, or picturing 1 through 3, Christ sitting on the throne at the right hand of the Majesty on high, he says, having become much better than the angels, he has inherited a more excellent name than they. From which of the angels did he ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you," and again, "I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me." So verse 5, he starts off with 4. And he's going to spend the rest of this chapter demonstrating through some proofs from the Old Testament how this idea of Christ is superior to the angels can be shown through the things that have been said in prophecy. And he's really, in part, leading up, not only to talk about angels as beings, and that's going to be in his argument, but as we introduced a little bit last class, the role of angels and how what they brought on the scene ends up being inferior to what Christ had to bring. in terms of his word, in terms of the good news. So we talked about these, I called them, in this case, just talked about being Old Testament quotations to prove his point. We talked about one, being out of Psalm, first being out of Psalms 2:7, and that is that he was the begotten Son of God. And the picture throughout this section is Christ where?
On the throne.
Sitting on the throne. He's king. He's reigning over his kingdom. Okay, and that's where he is. In fact, throughout the whole book of Hebrews, by and large, that's where we see Christ. And he'll reflect back on times, like when he died, for example, as he makes some arguments. But he's going to deal with Christ sitting on the throne, either as king, or we see in later chapters. And in fact, this chapter 5, verse 5, uses this same reference in Psalms 2, talking about his priesthood. He was made a priest, a high priest, when he went into heaven and took over his position as king and priest. And so that's the scope, if you like, of the, I don't want to say location, that's really not appropriate, but the scope of the view that's being taken here as far as Christ goes. Jim, you start to say something, or did you? No, that's okay. And then the second part of that verse, which we looked at, is a quote out of 2 Samuel 7, and again reaffirms this idea that the point that God had prophesied that Christ would be, that he'd have a king that would be on the throne of David forever, and so that's what's picked up in the second half of verse 5. It's just a unique relationship. There is no other Son of God like Christ. And that unique relationship will carry throughout the book. Verse 6 was the third one, see? And we talked about that in terms of the worship of angels. In D, looked at that similar aspect coming out of Psalms 104. And that is the angels do the bidding of God, or in this case, of Christ. And then we closed up on E, talking about the verses 8 and 9 being out of Psalms 45, and this righteous rule. And we'll say a little more about that later today, Lord willing. So we got down to verses 10 through 12. What's the quote out of? What Old Testament prophecy? Psalms 102. And this one, there's different ways you could answer the question about that I asked, what are the Old Testament verses, and that's straightforward. But what do they say about the Son? What does this one say about the Son?
Incarnate.
Okay,
Well,
is he? Is that 10 through 12?
He's talking about enduring. He's eternal. He's the creator.
Okay, in this case, you said incarnate. I'm going to ask you, how did you get that?
Psalms 102.
Oh, sorry. You took the whole Psalm. Okay. This particular part of it saying what? Somebody said something.
I said the Creator and also
he's
eternal.
Creator, he's eternal. But one other aspect about it that I think out anyway, and that is,
he's saying.
I use this big word, immutable. That word. Because the idea is unchanging, and his creation is creation unchanging. No, his creation is not unchanging. His creation changes all the time, and in fact, will eventually be destroyed. And then finally in 1:13, what's the reference to? Well, we've already visited, isn't it? In fact, and looks at, and first, what Psalm do you get that out of? Or what book is the Psalm?
110.
And it's looking at him where? Again. King, sitting at the right hand of God. So he used all these Old Testament quotations to prove it, to validate his point, in effect, the writer did. Okay? we actually covered, I want to talk about the rest of this. We've been talking about it some. We're going to elaborate on it a little bit. Verses 4 through 14. Different people may write this. You may look at this differently than I do. I'm going to look at it from the standpoint of three things: uniqueness, position, and rule. And remember, let me preface it by this. This writer, his overall theme is the superiority of Christ. He's writing to this group who has a problem. We've seen that in some of the marking we did. And he is making a case from the get-go, of a strong case, really, and in a redundant fashion about the superiority of Christ and why they need to remain faithful. And he's going to come at that in a different variety of ways, and he's going to be repetitive in terms of what he does. Okay? And therefore, I'm going to be a little repetitive. We talked about, as we went through this class, I think it was last class, emphasizing the idea, and evident already here, that we're looking at Christ sitting on his throne. It's the mediatorial reign that's being looked at in all of this. And he uses this terminology, today have I begotten you. Now, we think about begotten in different, and you have to really look at the word, how it's used in context. Here's pretty clear. Christ is declared to be the Son of God, the begotten Son of God, when he was established on the throne. So that's the framework in this particular book you're looking at. You're not looking at it from the standpoint of him being on the earth, but not from the standpoint of him being unique in the sense that he died, that he was to be sacrificed. You're looking at it from the standpoint of God's declared him. But not unlike the phraseology in Romans 1:1, declared to be the Son of God by the resurrection in that case. Here he's declared to be the begotten Son of God as he assumed his position, his rightful position, the result of the promise on the throne. Okay? And that'll get to be, it may seem obvious, but it may be helpful, particularly when we get into chapter 2, starting in verse 5. Okay? And we'll speak to that when we get there. So he's superior. This is where he is. And so this idea of superior starts to play out in the position he occupies. Okay? So then looking at 6 and 7, and when he again brings the firstborn. Anybody here got the New King James or King James they read out? Okay, I'll come back to you. Verse 6 says, and when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. And of the angels, he says, who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. Let me take you down to question 5 in your lesson. There's a statement in here that says, in the New American Standard says, and when he again brings the firstborn into the world. King James Version, the New King James says on that verse,
when he again brings the firstborn into the world.
And when
says,
he again brings, that's interesting.
But when he again brings.
Okay. But the New King James did it differently. King James will say, and again when he brings the firstborn into the world. So, is again, when he again brings the firstborn into the world, as in second coming? Or is it, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, as in, here's another example. Look at your footnotes if you got a New American Standard. You see, it says, NV, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world. World, and this is why I want to take you to question 5. World, when you look these up, what does world mean in Luke 1? I'm sorry, Luke 2, 1.
What is
the world? The Roman Empire. And anything to do with terra firma, does it? Or the creation, as do the Roman Empire. What is world in Acts 17:6?
The inhabited world. Inhabited world, like the surrounding area.
Okay, is it that? Well, the surrounding out, the surrounding is it that? It's a, even narrower than that in a sense. No.
This is in Acts.
Let's read 17:6. See, don't think of location when you read world. Don't always think of location. 17:6.
The world of believing or
They got fined them. They began dragging Jason and some of the brethren before the city authority, shouting, "These men have also upset the world to come here." What have they? What world have they upset?
This one.
Sorry.
His previous journey.
No.
The people.
What are these people? What are these people doing?
The Jews.
Thessalonians.
Okay, what do they worship?
Idols.
Which Adam? Remember?
Deanna.
Thank you. Okay. Very specific world. They've upset the world of those people who worship Deanna. That's the world in view here. Okay? So it's an idol worship subset, if you like, of people who worship Deanna. And it's not unlike, you know, John uses the term world a lot to mean the world of unbelievers. Those people who are unbelievers. Here, world, in this, what's being talked about here when he's in Hebrews, when he says, and again when he brings them into the world, what's the world we've just been talking about all the way up to this point now? In, maybe I'll say it differently, verses 1 through 5 of Hebrews. Where's Christ? On the cross. What's his world at this period, at this point?
He's in heaven ruling over the kingdom.
All things are subject to Christ at this point as king, which is everything at this stage. It's not talking about the earth, it's talking about his messianic reign and that which, that's the world that's in view. That which is under his rule. Okay? And that's the argument the writer's making. He's sitting on his throne. And when he says, and again when he brings him into the world he brings him into that's in view is the world of his rule. That's where he just got through sitting in this picture. Okay? Okay, I'm going to stop because I don't want a lot of glazed eyes. I mean, y'all understand that?
We do that today, and then we'll say that everyone knows we use words to describe emphasis or emphasize a point, and yet we know it doesn't mean it's
everyone.
Totality.
Yeah. So you keep it within the context. That's why I go back to this one all the time. Keep it in the context. This is what he's talking about. This is the world in view. It's not the world of earth. It's not, you know, it is his rule, the world of rule. And really, that for Christ, in fact, that's everything that comes along. And we can pick that up in other readings as Colossians and Ephesians in particular will describe Christ has been in authority over everything. In Matthew, he has been given all authority. And so this is the world in which is in view. And that, therefore, these things that come on behind this, and again he says this, and he brings in the world, he says this, and again when he brings in the world, he says this. Did angels worship God?
Sure.
From the very beginning, before he was ever king, Christ, before he was ever king on his throne? Of course it did. But that's not what's in view in this writer, by this writer. Okay? So, and true throughout the book. All right. Firstborn, another one of those words that you have to take in context. He says when he brings his firstborn, where is it? Where am I? And when he brings the firstborn into the world. Ah, so this is God's first child. He's got 13 others. So, I mean, if you're Mormon, you might buy into that. Now, what we know what, you know, firstborn can mean firstborn, as in child born. But it also has a term, it also has a meaning of superiority. Look in Psalms 89, 27, I'll show you the demonstration. He says in verse 27, and it's talking about David here, this psalm is, best I can tell. Sorry, Psalm 89, verse 27. And you see that you really see in this, in, as God described, the Holy Spirit describes David, his kingship, you see the terminology firstborn being defined. In this context, he says, I will stab, oops, sorry, I shall make him my firstborn, the highest of the kings on earth. Go to Colossians 1:15. You all familiar with this? And you're familiar with the use of firstborn in this sense, and it's the way it's being used here. Colossians 1:15 says he is the. I mean, I think we read this in one of our classes. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is before all things. I think the New American Standard, I hate to ask this question, you didn't stand behind him all this time. On my memory. Does it use the word preeminence in Colossians 1? Colossians 1:18 actually. It'd be 18.
And he is the 18, yeah. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning.
Colossians 1:18? Yes. Keep going. Sorry.
The church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. It is.
He may have preeminence.
The very last word is preeminence.
That he may have preeminence. This is the idea of firstborn. So when he brings his firstborn into the world, it's the preeminent one that's in view. Okay? And that's the terminology of firstborn we're accustomed to. And the idea of, as far as this writer is concerned, the superiority of this being is now on his throne.
Yes.
It's also.
Sorry, Jim? Okay.
It's also talking about being firstborn of the dead. In that he was raised from the dead, never to die again. That's what Revelation talks about.
Different. Look, firstborn can mean different things.
But in Colossians it says firstborn of the dead.
But he is firstborn. It defines what that is, what the purpose of that statement is, what firstborn means there, and that is he might have preeminence. He's the preeminent one. Yes, he is firstborn from the dead in that he will never die again. Been a lot of people raised from the dead. At least we know 500 were. 500 plus. Okay? 500? Bunch. Don't quote me on the 500.
Well, even back in the Old Testament, they were raised from the dead. Yeah, but this is a different.
And this is firstborn in the sense the firstborn never to die again. And the whole idea is the resurrection of the body. Okay. All right. So that preeminence, again, this idea of preeminence, the idea that the point that he's trying to make to this audience. Six and seven also says something about, and I did this in question city, also says something about the Son versus the angels in the area of worship. And this kind of comes out of even the generation of the Word. When it says you should be worshipped, what does the idea of worship entail or project or mean?
Well, you only worship something that is more superior. Is that where you're heading?
That's one. That's fact. And
worthy.
Yeah, that's right. Both those answers are right. And so that's what it says about the one who is to be worshipped. And so you go on, what does it say about the one doing the worshiping? Well, superior is to be worshipped. The one doing the worship being is clearly not the superior one, is he? It's an inferior one. And in this case, that's the angels, which is the statement he's trying to, the point he's trying to get through to these fellows. In fact, you know, Colossians, we won't go there, but Colossians, it was talking, I think, there about Gnostics, but Paul chastised those who worshipped angels. So there were people who worshipped angels. I think it came up in our very first class. I don't know if the Jews did, but Gnostics, those who, I say Jews, people who were actually trying to follow the Mosaic law, but certainly Gnostics did worship angels, and this was a problem. But angels are not deserving of worship.
Actually, you see them serving. I mean, he sent, and so, you know, they do his bidding. Yeah.
That's right. Next question, what are they? They're servants. And so you have a contrast, if you allow it, of one who is to be worshipped, a king to be worshipped, to be worthy, and he has servants, and those servants are angels. And those angels carry out the bidding in ways that we know about because it's recorded, in ways we don't know about as well. Okay, so he's superior in relative to his position, because of his position relative to the angel that the writer wanted to show to these folks. And he's also superior in rule. Verse 8 and 9, of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions. This is a little different take. Christ is really, as a king, there is no ruler like Christ. He is a righteous ruler. Look in Jeremiah 23.
None greater than him.
Sorry?
There's none greater than him.
None greater than him. And there's, you know, any, I don't care, in the annals of history, you'll never find a ruler who could be called righteous. They don't exist with the exception of Christ. In Jeremiah 23, in verse 5, and again, this is, you know, this is another messianic prophecy. Verse 5 of Jeremiah 23, he says, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch. He will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in all the land. In his days, well, let's just stop at that. We can go all the way down to the bottom of verse 6. It says, the Lord our righteousness. He was even called to that moniker. So that's the nature of the rule of this king. And so his rule is superior, not just because he's not superior just because he's ruler, but because the nature of his rule is superior as well. Okay? And of course, angels don't rule, and to the extent that we're aware of some of the actions of the angels, they're anything but righteous. You see Peter bring that point out. In Peter, I can't remember whether it's first or second. I think it's second. Okay, anything else about that before we move to 10 and 12? Okay, and then 10 through 12, he says, and you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. And they all will become old like a garment, and like a mantle you roll them up. Like a garment they will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to end. And we talked about this in here being creator that's laid out in this section, and the fact that he doesn't change, and the fact that he's eternal in nature. So this is of what angel can this ever be said? Of who else can this be said? only one other, well, two other beings that we're familiar with, and one being God the Father, and one being the Holy Spirit. So Christ is one, if you please, into the Godhead, very clearly. All right, and then verse 13 and 14, and to which of the angels has he ever said, to which of the angels has he ever said, so here's the contrast, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? So, again, here you have the angels contrasted with the king. God made the point for Jesus, set him on the throne, and re-emphasized the fact that in that environment, these angels are ministering servants, and they're not ministering servants simply to serve God, serve Jesus, as you might think of in a human sense. That they, I'm going to apply this to a human being. If you had a king and you had servants, it's like, bring me my supper. It's like, bring me my games or whatever. These servants have a different service. They serve for the purpose of his kingdom. Those who are under his rule, they serve you and me. You have your own angels. Servant, yes.
That I put down some verses like the role the angels had with Cornelius in Acts 10 and visiting him, and the Ethiopian eunuch, the role the angel had with Philip and helping the message to talk to
him.
And also Peter and John getting out of prison so they can go through.
Angels were active by revelation, they were active among the first century Christians, the apostles in particular, and the prophets. So it's a good point.
They killed a lot of people.
In the Old Testament, they did. They carried out God's vengeance, or justice. Okay, and then okay, anything else on that before we move into the next section?
Ed, one other thing you had mentioned about how the apostles preached against people worshiping the angels. There's a couple of occasions where we find people trying to worship the miracles of the angels. Well, today you have individuals that put forth people like Mary and some of the apostles and elevate them to a level which is almost like worship. Where you have Mary, she calls herself a bondservant of the Lord, and you have all these apostles that have done the work of the Lord and said they don't want to be worshipped. And some religions hold them up on such a high pedestal, it's almost the same.
Well, they are worship. I mean, Catholics worship some of these. Yeah. So it does happen today. Okay. All right, lesson five. Everybody okay? Lesson, I ask you a question, and I'll try to make sense out of this for you in a moment. What does parenthesis mean?
It's our stick a statement or statements in there to explain what you have said already and leading into what you're going to say next. I don't know.
I don't know works. This is the easy one.
The far, the
get your dictionary
the
out. Look.
Explanatory purposes.
Say what?
An insert for explanatory purposes.
Okay, well, what does it explain in general? Parenthesis generally is a digression. It interrupts the continuity. Now, having spent time talking about that, why in the world? Let's read 2:1-4. For this reason, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift away from it. For if the word spoken through angels proves unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience receives a just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those through her. God also testifying with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. There, I raise this point, ask y'all to look this up, because in a sense, this is a parenthesis. And in a sense, it is not a parenthesis. And I'll try to describe the two. Why I say that. It's an interruption because when we get to 2:5, he's going to pick up on angels again. He did not subject angels. So he's going to continue this angels discussion he's been having as to why Christ is better than the angels, and as well as the significance of what Christ did. Okay, so he's going to pick up that. He's going to look, what we look at in 2:5, we'll jump over 2:1-4 and go back to the preceding stuff. It's a parenthesis in that sense. However, and it, the four marking that I've mentioned in the past, 2:1 starts off, for this reason. Okay, what's the reason? For what reason?
Chapter 1.
That's just the easiest way to say it. He's held these angels up and shown how Christ is so superior to the angels. Now,
God put him in that position of being superior to the angels.
Well, more so than that, right. So his authority and his sense.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. All of the above. All right. I think we talked about this one of the last class. What are angels? What is the significance of angels to the Jews?
They didn't worship them, but they held them in high esteem because of the work that they had done.
Right.
They knew about.
What was the work? That's the point I'm trying to get to.
They were
messengers.
Like the Carnegies.
Okay, but the angels is true. But the angels to, now you're Hebrew. This goes back to remember your audience. You've been brought up on the, for X years, you've been brought up on the Old Testament. You're Jew. You've been converted, but you were Jew. All your culture base is Jew. We talked about the role of angels, and it's in a later question I asked you. Acts 7:53. What's Acts 7:53 say? Somebody read it. Or tell me what it says.
You who received the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it.
Okay. Look at Matthew 11:11. Matthew 11:11. What's Matthew 11:11 say?
Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist. But he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he.
That's obviously the wrong one I was looking for.
I want to make sure I looked and make sure it's in the right chapter.
Matthew 11:11. I must have been off sleep if I was looking at that. I must have had too much cold medicine or something. Well, you don't like that one. Look at Luke 17. We'll try that one.
Look at what?
Luke 17 and verse 9 and 10 for that matter. And I only look for one thing in here, and it's a word. Ordained may mean a lot of things in your mind. There's two times the word ordained is used in the Bible. One is in Acts 7:53, and the other one is in Galatians 3:19. Both of which are speaking to the same thing. That is, the law having been ordained by angels. Here is the same word in a different context. He does not, verse 9 of Luke 17, he does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? That word commanded, same word. Okay? Down verse 10. We are unworthy. So you too, when you do all the things which are commanded to you, same word. Ordained doesn't mean some you know fancy process. It has to do with communicating the word, and that's what the angels did. They ordained, communicated the word, the Old Testament, through the hands of them, or through a mediator, because ultimately it went to Moses and then to the people. And so here's the role of angels. That's why angels are so important to the Hebrews in this writer's argument. And so I want you to make that connection. Angels mean old law in their mind. Okay, it may not mean that to us, but it would mean that to them. And that's why it would be so important to them. Okay? And so he talks about paying closer attention, for the words spoken through angels proved unalterable. And he's not talking about just, you know, oh, the angel came down and spoke to Isaac, or the angel spoke to any number of people in the Old Testament. What he's really talking about, the contrast that's being made, that angels speak, is angels speak that delivered the word, the Mosaic law, ultimately responsible for the Mosaic law, the old law. That's the angel the angels speak that's in view. And so he makes this contrast. How will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? What is salvation here? And the rest of the verse explains it. What is salvation?
It's the whole for the gospel for the salvation.
So one of our figures of speech. Yes, that's correct. Autonomy. Salvation is put for the word of salvation, i.e. the gospel. And you see that, I mean, that's straightforward in the context. After it was first spoken, what was spoken? Salvation? No, the word of salvation was spoken. The gospel, that's what was spoken. So here's the contrast. If the word spoken by the angels proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense. In what sense is that a true statement? Now think about the Mosaic law for a minute. It says, it proved unalterable, and every transgression and disobedience received a just penalty or recompense. Yeah.
There's a transgression of law had a punishment, and there was nothing an individual could do that could stop God's judgment from occurring. God had to step in.
Could you, you know, it's interesting, I thought about this as an example. If you committed murder under the law, what was the penalty?
Death.
Yeah, law of God, death. You repent of that murder, and you can't bring the guy's life back. What's the penalty under the law?
Still death.
Death. Now you're under the word of salvation. Same murder. What's the penalty?
It might be physical death, but not spiritual death.
It might be physical death. Why?
Just
because the law of the land is physical death. Can you be forgiven of it and not suffer physical death, or certainly eternal death?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, in that context, people would look at this as a hard and fast thing. That was the nature of the beast. There's another aspect of it we'll talk about when we pick up here. This is the other way of looking at that. We'll pick up in this section, lesson 5. We should get through lesson 5. We may get to lesson 6 if you want to study ahead. I make no promises.